Theft, hair coursing and fly tipping, scourges of the countryside. But did you know that some of it has links to serious international organised crime?
The key word is organised. These aren't opportunist thieves. These aren't your casual burglars who are just out and seeing what they can grab. These are people that are targeting high-value equipment and, you know, taking it across borders.
We'll talk to the CLA this morning. We've announcements from two of our regular contributors, and it looks like the aphids are arriving early and in big numbers this year.
With such a high prediction of virus this year, 83% incidence predicted, and they're forecasting the date of the first arrival of flying misers per ski into crop somewhere around the 10th of April.
Plus the markets, the weather and the week's farming news.
The Week in Agriculture. This is the Farming Programme with Steve Orchard.
Hello, hope it's been a good week for you. Just a week to go till Easter and British summertime. What happened to spring? Welcome to our 200th programme together. Where have those 4 years gone? This is the Farming Programme podcast for the 24th of March 2024. I'm Steve Orchard. In the news this week, growers have welcomed British Sugar's announcement committing to cover 75% of their diversion costs following the difficult harvest. Significant additional costs have been faced in lifting beet in the very wet conditions, and some growers have had to deliver beet to alternative sites. A spokesperson for British Sugar said that given the wet conditions, they'll be reducing slice rates at Bury St Edmunds, Cantley and Wissington, increasing the campaign length, allowing growers to deliver to their contracted factory. Newark will continue to maximise the slice rate with available beet supply. DEFRA has announced compulsory registration requirements for all bird keepers as part of a new measure to combat bird flu. Under the changes, there will be new requirements, regardless of flock size, to officially register their birds. Currently, this is only required for flocks greater than 50. Keepers have until the 1st of October 2024 to register, and it's the 1st of September in Scotland. Six major supermarkets have now responded to the call for them to back our farmers by adding Buy British tabs to their websites. Waitrose and the Co-op are the latest, joining Sainsbury's, Morrisons, Aldi and Ocado. Still no word from Asda and Tesco. This follows an open letter to the chief execs of eight major supermarkets from Conservative MP Dr. Luke Evans. He asked for a filter which would direct shoppers to homegrown food to help the UK economy and cut our carbon footprint. And there's news from Louth's livestock market this week. There's been much chatter about changes of ownership at the market, not all of it accurate. So to set the matter straight, let's hear from the proverbial horse's mouth, Director Simon Williams. Morning, Simon. There are changes planned, but you're not selling out. The market's not closing. So what are you planning to do and why?
This has been long thought out. On the 1st of March, we wrote to around 750 farmers who regularly use the market throughout the year. In that letter, we stated our reasons why we have thought for some time now that the long-term future of the market in its current form and its current location is best owned by the farmers that need it for marketing their stock, their produce. Some of your listeners, Steve, won't no doubt realise, but there is a great number of farmer-owned markets throughout the country. The more local ones, if you can call them that, are Norwich, Selby, Rugby. So they're all markets that are owned and operated by the farmers for the farmers. Professional auctioneers do the day-to-day running, but the key decision-making and the capital and the profits that are generated are ultimately ploughed back into the market and for the shareholders and for the wider farming community, because we understand better than most, having run the market and been involved in the market for myself 20 plus years, and Russ not far off, and my father David before that for 50 plus years. In our view, it's a business for us, it's a community asset, really. We want to ensure that the future of the auction company and its lease is there for future generations. And whilst Russell and I have got no plans to step back at all in terms of our professional life, we aren't going to be here forever. And there is a degree of responsibility that we feel to running the market. And we've had a great deal of support from our farmer clients following the letter. There's some caution about what it means. And clearly, some perhaps don't fully compute what we're trying to explain to them. So we're going to have a meeting. We haven't quite set a date for that. It's likely to be in May. And we're going to invite our farmer clients, and users of the market to come and talk to us and hopefully air any questions that they've got.
But the idea is for farmers to buy shares in the market and it to be owned by farmers, but have a board to run it. Is that right?
Yes. So in brief, the proposal is that the shares that are currently owned by Russell and myself personally will be transferred to a group of farmers. We haven't sorted out the detail of that yet in terms of numbers of shares, etc. But we need a certain amount of working capital to run the market on a month-by-month basis. The market turns over in excess of £5 million a year, and that needs to be funded on a week-by-week basis. So the financial health of the market is good. It's very well run, we think, we hope, and it's a sound base. So the farmers will be invited to take over those shares and provide ultimately the working capital that the company needs to sustain itself. But importantly, those investors will receive a return on their investment through a return on an annual basis, which will be deducted from their commissions that they pay the market, and also hopefully dividends. The market has a stream of income from obviously livestock sales every Monday, and we have big special sales at peak times.
Yeah, so it's to protect the future of the market, which is, let's face it, a vital piece of the infrastructure of the town.
Absolutely, and that's not lost on us too. When we, back to 2019, the supermarket threat was very, very concerning to many, way beyond the farming community. And so the site is there for the town. It offers an events venue for other events. There's fairgrounds and firework displays, and there's talk of drive-in cinemas, and there's a motorhome stopover. So it's really being utilised as the council want us to. And our relationship with the council is excellent. It's improved dramatically since the upheaval, if you like, of 5 years ago. So we're really positive about the future, but acutely aware that Russ and I can't be responsible for it and can't run it forever. And we would not want to have had all the hard work and support we've had from the farmers over many, many years, who are our clients and friends in many cases, to then be ill-prepared for an eventuality that we can't run it anymore. And so this is a tried and tested route around the country. There's dozens and dozens of farmer-owned markets, and we're just really looking to replicate that style of ownership.
So this is as much about succession planning, if, heaven forbid, something were to happen to either of you two.
It is succession planning. It is absolutely. And you say heaven forbid kindly, but the reality is this company will, we hope, and the market will exist way beyond my working life and my natural life. So and Russ the same. So we want it to be seen as very much a long term planning exercise. We think it's a responsible thing to do. We've had a lot of thought. We've taken advice, spoken to other markets, and there's nothing for me says to me that this is the wrong thing to do. In fact, it's a very, very positive step, we think. And just to be clear, if I can make this point, is that we're not selling out. There isn't. We are offering the shares to the farmers. We may retain some minor shareholding because I'm a sheep. I have a flock of 100 ewes myself, so I'm a farmer user of the market as well in a relatively small way. So I would retain farmer shares. It may or may not be the case that Masons Rural is the firm that does the day-to-day administration. That's something that the board would decide on. So we want 6 or 8 farmers to take a key role, and they would be appointed on behalf of their shareholders. It's a very positive, collaborative step.
What's the response been so far?
It's been warm. I think people understand how important it is. I think people perhaps don't fully understand the financial responsibility perhaps that comes with it. It's not something we shy away from, but perhaps it's been, I think people, some have admitted, we sort of take it for granted a little bit. And perhaps the letter that we sent rectifies some of those perhaps misconceptions. There certainly isn't any panic. There's nothing, the market is well funded, it's secure, it's profitable, modestly, and long may it continue.
Well, I couldn't have put it better myself to wrap things up. Long may Louth's livestock market continue in whatever guise it might be or whatever structure it might be. But Simon, thank you for that information, and thank you for the just putting things straight as to exactly what's happening and why. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you for your support and obviously everyone who supports us week in, week out.
The regular weekly market report from Louth is coming up later in the programme. And another regular contributor to the programme, Openfield, have an announcement for us. A partnership. No, not a merger. A link with the Farming Community Network, the FCN. Openfield's Richard Kay. Good morning. What's the purpose, Richard, of the partnership? How's it going to work?
So, yeah, teaming up with the Farming Community Network is really important to us, and something that we've been talking to them for a while about. You know, farming is challenging, and often people find themselves very lonely, feeling isolated and no one to talk to. And the FCN are a very professional, well-organised organisation who actually have their roots in farming. So I think they understand farming far better than anyone else involved with well-being and mental health. So we just thought it was great to partnership with the guys to raise awareness of what they do and just provide channels for anyone who's thinking that they need to talk to someone about how they're feeling.
You obviously have relationships with a lot of farmers, as do FCN. You see what goes on a practical basis day to day out in the fields. And as you say, awful lot of loneliness, an awful lot of stresses and pressures business wise and this kind of thing. Is this an awareness raising partnership, or is there a practical nature to the synergy between the two organisations?
There are two distinct separate strands to this. Definitely making our members more aware of what's going on, but also farmers generally. You know, we've got a very active social media account. We talk to thousands of farmers every year. We meet them out and about at shows and at trade fairs, and we're going to offer FCN the opportunity to attend some of those and just, you know, raise awareness of that. So it is raising awareness and getting people to talk to each other. But the second strand is that we're going to put all our farmer-facing colleagues through some training that FCN will deliver, which will help them spot people who potentially might need help and to point them, signpost them to FCN in a professional and supportive way.
On a practical basis, when does this all start? And are you going to be, well, you're announcing it obviously in terms of press releases and things like that, but is there a bit of a campaign to tell farmers about it?
There is. We've already emailed our own accounts, members to let them know and provided the contact details. So that will be ongoing. The training will happen over the next few months. We've got a number of meetings already planned leading up to harvest and then after harvest. So FCN will be at those. So we're already up and running.
Good, good. And of course, locally, Lincolnshire Rural Support Network is closely allied with FCN, isn't it?
It is, yes. And of course, that's specific to Lincolnshire, something that we're also supportive of, and we get those guys to one or two of our events too. For us, the attraction to FCN was the fact that they're national, and with Openfield being a national business, the synergy in terms of our reach and their support was the one that worked in terms of raising wider awareness.
Great stuff. Where could somebody go for more about this? Websites?
Yeah, so it's fcn.org.uk, but anyone needing confidential help can call them any day, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. And their number is 03000 111999, or they can email help@fcn.org.uk.
All right, Richard, thank you for that. Great to hear of the tie-up between two important organisations. Richard Kay from Openfield, thanks for joining us on the Farming Programme this morning.
You're very welcome.
Aphids arriving early, rain not going away, another challenging week in the fields with not many seeds going in. Good morning to our crop doctor, Sean Sparling. Morning, Sean.
Morning, Steve. Yeah, another week of weather. -1 frost last weekend, then lovely warm days, 15 up to 20 degrees Monday, Tuesday, bright sunshine, And despite that, this blooming rain came back and it's still holding up cultivations and stopping us drilling on far too many fields across the county. 10 mills Wednesday into Thursday. When we can't drill on the heath and when water stands on the Lincolnshire Wold, you know it's wet. And to put that in perspective, a millimetre of rain puts 1 litre of water on every square metre of land, which is 10,000 litres per hectare. 1,000 litres to a cubic metre, and a cubic metre of water weighs a tonne. So 1 millimetre of rain, just 1 mil, gives 10 tonnes of water on every hectare. There are 25.4 mil of rain in an inch, so an inch of rain puts 254 tonnes of water on every hectare. We've had over 28 inches of rain since September the 10th, and that's over 7,100 tonnes of water on every hectare. An Olympic-sized swimming pool, if you picture that, is 50 metres long, 25 metres wide, 2 metres deep. That holds 2,500 tonnes of water. So the land has had almost 3 Olympic-sized swimming pools full of water on every hectare since September the 10th. That's caused the land to slump down in the profile. It's stopping the land drains from effectively carrying the water away, particularly in fields that have been drained but not backfilled onto those porous pipes with any gravel or aggregate. And a lot of fields have been drained like that over the last 10-15 years. So consequently, you dig a hole a foot deep in a field and it fills up from the bottom. It's that wet, and that's why it's that wet. But most of our winter cereals now have had their first 80 kilos or so of nitrogen, but there's been very little drilling, barring a bit of spring barley, maybe a little bit of spring wheat on the kinder land. But most of the huge area of planned spring barley, all of the sugar beet, all of the spring wheat, the peas, the beans, the potatoes and everything else that goes in the spring has yet to start drilling. Spring barley and peas in particular, they won't be mauled in, so you're going to have to wait. It's soon getting late enough for spring wheat to do any good. You preferably need a decent, fine, firm seedbed for sugar beet. You know, we can go on. I'll leave that there. Oilseed rape then. Yellow bud, first flowers in the forward bits since we last spoke. Green bud widespread, even in the backward stuff. And fields still dying on their feet from cabbage stem flea beetle and rape winter stem weevil. Far too many risks and way too few rewards as things stand with oilseed rape. Pollen beetle appearing now. They emerge middle of March and it's temperature sensitive emergence in temperatures over 15 degrees. So the mild weather at the end of last week and the beginning of this week has clearly triggered them into action. We have thresholds of pollen beetle for good reasons. They protect your crops and they protect the predators. Oilseed rape crop produce around 60% more buds than ever turn into pods. So you do have plenty of leeway there. And 80% of the insect life in an oilseed rape canopy is made up of beneficials. So those pollen beetles, which are in the yellowing up early flowering crops, are now beneficials in their own right because they've turned from pests to pollinators. So it's the more backward green-budded bits, which are at the highest risk from pollen beetle, who will search out the pollen and start eating into those green buds. Pyrethroids, of course, largely useless anyway against pollen beetle, but unfortunately, they're still incredibly active on the beneficials. Little things like Microtonus brassicae, which help fight the cabbage stem flea beetle larvae in the autumn, and all those other little beneficial insects that make up that 80% of insect life. So if the crop's got any yellow in it, those pollen beetle will be attracted to the yellow. So once the crop starts to flower, don't spray insecticide in that rape crop under any circumstances at this stage. If you're looking at backward crops at green bud, then the thresholds are, if you have fewer than 30 plants a square metre, 25 pollen beetle per plant. 30 to 50 plants, it's 18. 50 to 70 plants, it's 11. And if you have over 70 plants a square metre, then it's 7 beetles per plant. Headlands and the odd yellow plants are always going to be worst affected because the beetles will head for that yellow and just swamp them. So ignore those, take a representative picture of the field. Whether you spray them or not, the yield of the rape is going to be pretty much the same, but the damage you'll do to the beneficials will be far, far greater than the damage you'll do to the pollen beetles if you do spray. So there you go. I won't be spraying my rape once again this spring for pollen beetle. Yellow rust still moving in winter wheat. Cool, wet conditions, perfect for yellow rust. But check the varietal yellow rust information because plenty of varieties out there get it at the seedling stage, but then the resistance kicks in from stem extension. Know thine enemy and all that. And don't panic. Septoria widespread too in winter wheat. Black pycnidia, sexual spores in the lesions now too when you look. Even finding it in extase. Again, wet, mild, windy weather, perfect for Septoria. But apart from a few forward early drilled plants, I've got nothing where leaf four is fully out, and leaf four emerged in the tip of the developing ear a centimetres from the top of the basal node is your T0 timing. So make sure the growth stage is right if you're putting in plant growth regulators. Incidentally, spring barley drilled after mid-March tends to be very low risk for barley yellow dwarf virus, so every cloud and all that. So we may as well let the ladybirds, lacewings, wasps, hoverflies, birds, spiders and all the other little things which are appearing now in big numbers do their bit for you. That is what IPM is all about. Winter beans, if you've got any, it's moving now. So if you've got any brassica weeds or cranesbill in them, you can still apply bentazone for now. Don't go if there's any signs of buds. And the sunniest day you can find will give you the best result from bentazone. I've got no sugar beet in the ground yet. And with such a high prediction of virus this year, 83% incidence predicted, and they're forecasting the date of the first arrival of flying misers persici into crops somewhere around the 10th of April. So what this delay to drilling the beet this year means is that even if we were going to get drilling next week, which seems very unlikely at the moment, it's unlikely to be cruiser protected seed because that's probably not going to be on farm before early April. The unprotected sugar beet would be emerging as those aphids arrive. The reality is then that most of the beet, treated or otherwise, is going to be emerging after the misers persici have started to move into crops and lay those young. It could well be a very, very challenging sugar beet season. We have so few foliar spray options available to us after emergence. So as ever, timing will be everything, and we could easily see aphid thresholds reached before peri-emergence, and that is not something I look forward to seeing. So how much fun is farming? It's a blooming hoot, isn't it? Let's see what the next 7 days bring.
Indeed. Many thanks, Sean. Organised crime is targeting the rural community. It's getting serious. We'll discuss a new report and check the markets and the weather on the Farming Programme next.
The Farming Programme with Araquip Steel Stockholders, Withambrook Industrial Estate Grantham, supplying the region for over 40 years.
This is the Farming Programme podcast. I'm Steve Orchard. Has crime in the rural community been taken seriously? Is hare coursing still viewed as the poacher with a shotgun catching his lunch? Is fly tipping just really a few black bags dumped at the side of a lane? No, it's really serious stuff. And a new report from the National Rural Crime Network, commissioned by Durham University, is pointing at links with the really serious side of international organised crime. CLA Acting Regional Director Mark Riches.
Indeed, I think it's fair to say that those who are in the rural community have had long-standing beliefs that, you know, when people talk about hare coursing, they think of it as a fairly victimless and a fairly almost slightly romantic crime, you know, the old poacher with his dogs out catching his lunch type of thing. And I think it's fair to say that kind of rural idyll, as people view it, no longer exists. Hare coursing these days, in particular, is a serious gambling sport that is broadcast online, and it's often run by gangs of individuals who are involved not only in this sport but in other very sort of high profile and sort of large scale crimes. Syndicates and organised crime activities. So we're quite often seeing where people are being the victims of hare coursing, for example. You'll find in the weeks following that they are then the victims of other crime, whether that be thefts of farm machinery, thefts of plants, you know, and it does generally revolve around theft. So the report itself has very much highlighted the fact that those involved in hare coursing are far wider than just hare coursers. They are organised international, often international criminal gangs that are involved in this activity.
And they're involved in things like drugs and smuggling and so on. This is serious stuff, isn't it? Not just some opportunist who sees an unattended tractor and thinks, I'll have that. This is proper organised, the type of stuff you see on the telly, on crime shows, isn't it?
Absolutely. The key word is organised. These aren't opportunist thieves. These aren't your casual burglars who are just out and seeing what they can grab. These are people that are targeting high value equipment and taking it across borders. And as you quite correctly say, you know, this is large scale crime. This is drug trafficking. This is people trafficking in some situations. This is serious stuff, not just hare coursing and not just sort of small scale burglaries type of thing.
What sort of stuff's been taken? I mean, we know the cost of agricultural machinery is quite incredible in some cases, but is there any particular type of equipment that's being taken?
Yes, I mean, it's plant, as we call it. So your excavators, your dump trucks, your bulldozers, those kind of things, very much sort of construction equipment. That's very popular. It can be stripped down for parts and taken to other parts of the world. And because it isn't going as a complete machine, it's very difficult to trace. And also, once stripped down for parts, it's worth far more than when it's in one piece. The other thing we're regularly seeing is the theft of the very high precision global positioning systems that are used on agricultural machinery and agricultural tractors. And obviously there's a very big call for that in other parts of the world as well. So that kind of equipment is stolen on a very, very regular basis.
It's just for those who may not understand this, and I didn't, I must admit, we're not talking about your little sat-nav that you have on the car dashboard here, are we? We're talking some seriously expensive bits of kit.
We are indeed. We're talking seriously expensive bits of kit. It's not just the bit of kit itself. It's often the damage they do getting it, but also the damage they do often getting into the buildings to steal it in the first place. We're often talking, you know, people taking fairly heavy duty cutting gear and cutting through walls, cutting through doors and doing some serious damage just to try and get this stuff.
And of course, the downtime that results from this stuff being stolen, that machine's out of commission until it's replaced.
Absolutely. That's quite correct. Yes.
So this report has come up with all this from the National Rural Crime Network. Durham University commissioned it. What are they actually saying by way of recommendations?
It's fair to say that we've always pushed for, you know, the police to recognise that those involved in what might be seen as sort of lesser crimes, such as hair coursing, are taken seriously. And we've certainly seen some very good examples of where the police have undertaken operations to catch those involved in hair coursing and poaching, have often found that they have picked up people with far more serious crimes and far more serious convictions against their names. There is now a realisation that by picking up these people, often they can help themselves, you know, find the answers to the bigger crimes. Ultimately, it's about making sure that the police share intelligence. It's about making sure that the police understand what needs to be done and the value of picking up these people. And also that making sure that we have properly funded rural crime teams and properly funded police forces. So we'll be calling upon government to make sure that there are the resources available for the police to do their job.
I think we're fortunate in Lincolnshire and some other rural counties where we have the Rural Crime Action Team, but really we're calling for a lot more here, aren't we? A lot more support, a lot more infrastructure to enable the police to be more effective.
Indeed, and Lincolnshire is very fortunate. It does have a very, very good rural crime team. And in fact, I met with the rural crime team only a few weeks prior. And Lincolnshire does very well for the money it has allocated to it. It's one of the rural crime teams with the lowest budget, one of the police forces with the lowest budget. But actually what it does with that is incredibly effective. And certainly, you know, they are very positive in their outlook. One thing I would say is to appeal to listeners. I know sometimes it can be frustrating to report crimes. You think you won't get a response. You think you won't get you'll just be fobbed off for where the crime number is, something we often hear. What I will say, though, is please do report these crimes. The police need the data. The police need the evidence. They need to make the case for proper funding, for proper budgets, to make sure the officers that they've got are kept. So please do report crimes to them. And if you see a crime in process, do phone 999. And that's directly from the police forces themselves. They have asked, if you see a crime in process, phone 999 and they will respond. So the more data they have at their disposal and the more they can see what's going on, even if they can't always respond, it helps them make their case and it helps them point out to the Police and Crime Commissioner and to help the Police and Crime Commissioner make a case for increase for funding for the police force.
So, Mark, where could we get hold of a copy of this report then?
If you go to nationalruralcrimenetwork.net, you'll be able to download a copy of the report there, and I would certainly encourage people to do so.
Yeah, and all the full recommendations are listed on there as well. Mark Riches from the CLA, thank you once again for joining us on the Farming Programme this morning.
Thank you, Steve. Pleasure, as always.
Links FM Farming. Market reports.
Starting as usual with livestock from Mason's Rural at Louth Market, auctioneer Ed Middleton. Morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. This week, an excellent show of prime cattle, heifers, an all-in average of 281.1 pence per kilo, and steers, an all-in average of 274.5 pence per kilo. Top price in the heifers was C.A. Mottram and Sons of Lincoln at £1,619.80. And in the pence per kilo in the heifers, again, the Mottrams of Lincoln at 311.5 per kilo. Top price in the steers were G.S. Paul of Borough La Marche at £1,883. And top in the pence per kilo in the steers were J.C. Scully of Bournemouth at 287.5 per kilo. Cool cows this week topped to the 177.5 per kilo for S.A. and V.J. Elwis. Moving on to the store cattle, some excellent runs of quality bred farming cattle and a ring full of buyers making delightful reading. Taking the top spot this week were A.W. Lewis and Son of Louth with a 16-month-old Limousin heifer at 1,300. A super run of 12 to 14-month proper farming cattle from Pennell Brothers of Louth averaged an impressive £1,083.93, topping at £1,210 for a Limousin heifer. Moving on to the sheep, fantastic show of hogs this week, numbers on the rise. This week we had an SQQ of 376.23 per kilo and an all-in average of £100 per head of £170.46. This week we had 36 pens over 400 per kilo, topping at 438 per kilo for TR and J Fox of Market Raisin. A super run of 76 hogs from Scrilsby Farms Limited Horncastle topping the day's trading at £225, with their run of hogs averaging a whopping £190.24. Handy show of cull ewes this week with an all-in average of £125.95. Top price this week was S.P. Chapman of Louth at £210. I'm Edward Middleton, auctioneer at Louth Livestock Market.
Thanks, Ed. And to the grey markets now with Open Fields' Alice Killam. Morning, Alice.
Good morning, Steve. Whisper it quietly, but this tiny bull run that we've seen in the last few sessions has continued. Or, to be more specific, it hasn't lost it all again, with old crop May Liffey back over 170. That's circa £12 from the bottom. A long way from the 195 to 205 range, I appreciate, though. In truth, the narrative is no different from a week ago. Further short covering as we get closer to what is often a market-moving report next week on the 28th of March, the US Quarterly Stock and Prospective Plantings Report. For those who have sold it short, they only make the profit when they buy back their position. You, like I, hope that we have seen the bottom. Further afield, we are seeing values rise off the bottom also. In Russia, where they have seen their export values fall $44 since the turn of the year, in an effort to grab whatever demand there was. Granted, this is still cheap wheat, circa $8 to $9 cheaper than the French 11% wheat, but if everyone moves up a little, so must the cheapest. Staying in the Black Sea, we've seen further reports in the last 48 hours detailing what we might expect from the EU in the way that they're going to handle the imports of Ukrainian goods. This is a delicate situation for them. On one hand, they wish to be seen as supporting Ukraine against Russia, but they must also be seen to show support for their own. Farmer protests, which do matter to the government in large parts of the EU, have not gone away. Indeed, in Poland this week, they've got much worse. In the UK, we are reacting to others. If the value of imported products moves up, then we will move up alongside it. And finally, we are also seeing some local demand, with many consumers pricing produce higher up the food chain. As with most reports that I'm reading, the end of them normally warns caution to us returning to rampantly bullish tendencies. I suspect that they're right. We only have 4 months left to move quite a lot, and May would be almost full already. We will be helped by a £20 carry between old crop May and new crop November futures, with the latter dragging the former higher. But if we need to move produce in a timely manner before harvest, then it's probably prudent to continue quietly trading. If you can carry or fancy a punt, then I've heard of worse ideas, but we don't want it all to be stuck at the end with nowhere to go. New crop is a difficult one. On lighter land, spring barley and spring wheat is going in, but for much of the area, we can barely travel, let alone drill anything. The end of next week is April. This will clearly have further impacts on the AHDB early bird numbers, but as we saw from the import numbers on Tuesday evening, our values will be governed by others. Let's hope this little bull run keeps going. Note the rapeseed market is moving. There is very little old crop left, having reached £350 per tonne once again. But with lower EU plantings being confirmed midweek, new crop rapeseed is bid circa 365 to 370x. Certainly one to watch. Finally, your guide prices for this week, circa Friday morning. feed wheat, April 160 to 170 and November 185 to 195, with Group 1 milling premium still holding between £60 and £70. Feed barley, May 135 to 145 and November 155 to 165. All seed rape, February 355 to 360 and July 360 to 370. As usual, please do call for firm values.
Thanks, Alice.
The Farming Programme. 5-day forecast.
Another wet week by the looks of it, just for a change. Winds this week will be mostly south to southeasterly and moderate in strength. There's rain forecast for most days, particularly Monday. Daytime temperatures just nudging double figures and down to 5 overnight. Clocks forward next week then, Easter Sunday and 100 days since Short Ferry Bridge closed due to flooding, and it's still closed. We'll report from the Turret Arms and we're looking ahead to the British Farming Awards and we'll see how lambing's going. I'm Steve Orchard. Until then, have a great week.
The Farming Programme with Arroquip Steel Stockholders with Umbrook Industrial Estate Grantham. BSI ISO 9001 accredited.